My name is Professor Ramesh. I'm at the Computer Science and Mathematics Department as well. And I'm going to be covering the next four classes and four lectures. So that is this lecture, the next Monday, and then the following Friday is actually not going to be a lecture, but we'll have lectures in January, which will follow. So the schedule will be provided to you. So effectively, the two lectures for this part of the year is today and Monday. Okay. So today, what I'm going to do essentially is to first of all, this lecture is going to be in English. So it's a slight change between the other lectures. And what I will try to do is to give you an outline of two things. First, essentially, is a brief overview of what we do in the software engineering chair, just to give you an idea of what's going on in software engineering in building complex systems. And then the next thing that I would try to highlight in this talk is a broad picture. A broad picture of actually what is going on in computer science and why you should actually do programming and why you should actually look at working in large teams and what is really the future in some sense, at least from a perspective of the area that I'm researching in and others who collaborate with me. So that is actually one part of it which is not exactly introduction to programming, but it essentially is an idea to motivate you to seek and understand a broad range of things, which is interdisciplinary in some sense. Computer science is actually going to be a pivotal in terms of facilitating a whole range of complex automation systems. And essentially, the idea is that you have a whole range of data, data from all walks of life, data from mobiles, data from sensors, data from the Internet of Things. And then all of these are basically aggregated, and then they're integrated into society. And computer science and programs are obviously going to be a key element of this in allowing you to manage the complexity of all this stuff. That's number one. And at the same time, it helps you in terms of changing the way we live, and even the idea of how this would shape the directions we go in terms of where the future is. So I will try to highlight some of these elements, at least in the first part of the talk, to give you a sense of, you know, what is going on. Take some examples from Google, take an example from Siemens, give you some ideas, given my industry background. Then, that is the first half, probably, of this talk. I don't know how long that will take, probably 40 minutes maximum. Then after that, what I will do is I will just connect back to what you've seen so far. So you've seen, so far, you've learned Python programming, you've learned data structures, you've learned about object-oriented programming or object-oriented design and issues in terms of model specification, UML. So what I will do is start from there, what you've learned, and then go more towards applied examples. And today I will focus on two examples, largely using graphs. And the second, the next part of our talk in the following weeks would be really on this theme of data analysis. So you have a large amount of data coming in, and you have basically tools that you need to use to process them. So can you actually introduce you to basically data analysis using Python? So that's basically going to be my overall structure of my lecture. And in that, I would try to briefly introduce you to image processing concepts and machine learning concepts. Just brief introduction, just to give a flavor, and to also use some libraries and play with some examples. So the bulk of the presentation that I give today, especially on the data structures and the actual programming side, it comes from Princeton. From the computer science department at Princeton, Robert Sedgwick, who's well known in the algorithms community. And by the way, I spent close to 16 years in Princeton in Siemens. And so essentially, that's going to be the book. There is a link in the bottom of this page, which illustrates basically the first four chapters. And that's good enough for you to follow what I'm talking about. In fact, what I'm presenting is material from there. So let's start with, first of all, the background of what my background personally, and what do we do in our computer science software engineering chair. So my background essentially is that I studied in India, went from there to the US, and studied in Virginia Tech, and a master's in computer engineering. Then went to University of Washington. It's one of the top computer science schools and computer science engineering schools. And I was fortunate to work in, with a number of people in University of Washington. Then I joined, actually, Siemens in 1995, end of 94, and was fortunate to build a large collection of real-world systems in basically data analysis, especially computer vision systems. Systems that can actually look at pictures, look at images, look at videos, look at medical images, diagnostic images, and then understand the content. So that's basically what my focus has been. And so if you want to label me as one label, you can use two words, systems thinker. So essentially, effectively, systems thinking is at the heart of all that what we do. So we think in terms of a systemic way, how to model software, how to model complex systems, and then how to actually build complex systems. Even organizations, whether you build large teams and organizations and execute, they are also, you can think about it in a systemic way. So that's why my background has fortunately been in a number of these areas, including system science, engineering, and management. So what do we do in Frankfurt? So there is two parts to where, what we focus on. One essentially is what I would call design patterns for intelligence. So essentially the idea of, you know, currently software essentially is constructed largely by humans, right? So you basically have some customer coming and saying, I want this, or a user want to do some X in a mobile phone or something. And then you take the specification of what you think you want to do, and then you map it to a software. And then you have to go through several steps to build a software. So in this sense, largely the software process of developing a software is actually semi-automatic. What do I mean by that? I mean you essentially have humans involved in the software construction, and humans involved in the design, and humans involved in validation. Of course, it's basically used by humans, therefore humans are involved. Now, on the other hand, what's going on in the field essentially is more and more autonomous software construction. What do I mean by autonomous software construction? What we mean by that essentially is, just like we are when we are born as a baby, you're born with actually a substrate, like the brain, and essentially you are embedded in the world. And then you observe the world, and then you're taught through examples, and then you evolve your learning of actually of what is going on in the world. In that sense, you're building models, and then you're able to use the same machinery, in this case our brain, to be able to essentially solve a variety of problems, new problems, unforeseen problems, even formulate problems. So in that sense, basically, what we are learning machines and flexible, adaptable machines. Now, in fact, the whole of computer science has been moving away from essentially, you know, the classic logic and structured programming stuff to more and more machine learning and data analysis. And in fact, bio-inspired computation and the flexible use of our understanding of the brain, understanding of actually psychology, understanding of other complex systems to be able to then drive how can you build intelligent systems. So my research focus essentially is on how do you think about building a design theory for intelligence. So in other words, if there is indeed a new problem you want to solve, how can I quickly design a system? That's the research focus. But this research, of course, is isolated just as a theory is not enough. It needs to be built into software tools and platforms, which are then applied to society. So essentially, that is why we have a separate pillar or a separate layer which addresses the building of software, complex software, software tools and platforms. And currently we have a project which is called the Bernstein Focus, where we have built a platform for software engineering for complex systems. And then these software can be then applied to many industrial needs. So in that sense, my personal focus is in not just systems theory or system science, but also in engineering construction of these systems and then applying them in practice. And the whole question that we have right now, the challenge that we have is, how can you do this efficiently? How can you do this in teams effectively? How can you train people to become these system thinkers who can work in large teams? How can you actually translate these ideas into practical problems, solving solutions, to essentially apply them and make an impact in society? Whether it be global warming, whether it be the security and safety, whether it be other types of big challenges you face, industrial automation. So this is basically the big questions. So it is actually, in some sense right now, it's great to be a computer scientist, because programming, it's getting more and more, I would say, there's a lot of blocks there. But then the issue really is, how do you put them together effectively? How do you actually connect them together? How do you work in teams? How do you actually deploy these solutions fast? How do you interact with them? So the world is interconnected. There is a lot of tools available and principles available. Now, how do you go to the next level of complexity? So this is actually what computer science is all about now. And computer science has moved from logic and formal theories to more statistics, more learning. Okay, so there's a marriage between statistical methods and essentially computer science. So that's why my focus in the teaching is on Bayesian statistics and machine learning. So I hope I gave you sort of an introduction to the large and longer focus, long-term focus of my own personal interest. It has actually large impact, and I think it needs actually large, young, driven, motivated people to learn the principles and to become really these system thinkers and team players and future leaders. So in my opinion, it's actually an exciting time to be a computer scientist. And I want to give you a picture of what essentially is that excitement, at least from my perspective of what I've seen, and then what is going on now in the outside world. So first thing I'm going to talk about essentially is data analysis. So when we talk about the human brain, we are constantly processing data. So 50% nearly 50% of our brain is, probably that number is a bit high, but is basically dedicated to vision. So I'm processing information from here, looking at this audience. I'm seeing, are they paying attention? Which side should I turn? And I actually get a rough sense of how many people there are. I expect actually 500 people, but it's not 500. Looks like maybe 100, and maybe 100, maybe 150, perhaps, yeah? But I'm doing that all in an instant, like this, yeah? And how is it that I'm doing that, right? It's basically, so when you're born as a child, you are born with actually certain basic primitives, like you can recognize a blob, like a face, mother's face. You can recognize a mother's voice, you can turn, perhaps. Yeah, to a sound, and then maybe you can recognize motion. When you move, then you know that there is something going on. But beyond that, what is going on is that you are actually bootstrapping from a basic machinery to essentially learn all the rich properties of the world, the regularities of the world. So what are the patterns in the world? And then you're building a large memory of that pattern. And then you're using that large memory to quickly guess, what is it that I'm seeing right now? Is it like what I expect? This is like the model I've built up. And whenever the expectation is not met, then there is a cause for actually learning to happen, essentially. So effectively, what you are essentially is a continuously observing, in some sense, computer with a large memory, with a fancy data structure, okay? And the data structure itself is learned, updated, and maintained. And you have certain expectation models, okay, certain goals, like okay, instinctive drives and so on. And that's what's going on, right? Now, what's going on in actually in computing science to replicate such a systems? So I will start with actually some examples from Siemens. This actually is a presentation that I gave at the European Conference on Computer Vision in 2010 as a manager from Siemens. And what you see essentially already in 2010 was that there's a lot going on in terms of hardware. You had much better sensors. You had much more high resolution sensors. If you take a mobile phone now, you can get several megapixel cameras in your mobile phone. And then they have high dynamic range. So they actually can actually take pictures with different brightness levels and so on and adjust. And they are smart and embedded, meaning that in the mobile phone, you have all the processing that's already there. You have the ability to detect faces maybe and then focus on the face better and so on. And the core of actually, so there's a lot of software in there, of course, embedded software, which is going into the to building the acquisition system and so on to get the data in. Then, of course, you have to process that data, and you can take a large amount of examples, and then you can build using the knowledge about how we know about learning in the brain and so on. We can build machine learning algorithms that can recognize actually patterns. And then, if you build such a complex system like a brain, how do you analyze it? That's already a big field by itself. That's what I mean by system engineering for complex systems. And then the other question is, how do you visualize this data? If I, for example, in the top left, you see actually a 3D volume actually of inside the body extracted from a computer tomography scan and X-ray, but taken with multiple slices. And then you're able to visualize that using visualization tools, graphics tools. So here you see computer graphics advances, here you see data processing advances, machine learning, and if you are, in any of these, if you had a BMW already in 2010, you would have seen that they had traffic sign recognition. They could recognize a variety of traffic signs in the in Germany, right? And they could also do things like lane departure warning, and they could keep a distance to the truck in the front of you, and they could actually basically keep essentially do automatic cruise control, so effectively let you take your hands off. But nowadays, if you go to, if you hear the news, every day you talk about the autonomous car and the self-driving car, the Google car, or maybe even Apple is working on it. And all the German manufacturers are also working on it. So essentially, that's where this is going, right? And that's all about software. So in a car, you have millions of lines of code inside the car to do all these things. So here is an example of what, again, something comes out of Princeton in Siemens lab, where you see actually multiple slices of actually computer tomography scan, and then essentially, are, and basically, you're able to see the heart being segmented and tracked and so on. And you can see essentially, you could even quantify the valve properties, and you can check valve defects and so on. So essentially, you this is again showing you the complexity of what you can do with software, right? And what is needed. And here is actually all systems that we built, again with Siemens, the traffic sign recognition, the automatic cruise control. By the way, if you are ever in the A4 highway in Cologne, this was a project that I did in Cologne in 1999, 2000. To basically have a Standstreifen monitoring system, which allows you to automatically open the lane. Yeah. And then here, if you're ever in the Switzerland in tunnels, you will see our systems in operation where you have actually danger in tunnels being announced early so that you can actually react. Because in the late 90s, there were some major accidents in tunnels that required actually tunnel safety systems to be built. Yeah. So The reason I'm motivating you again to just give you these real-world examples is to show you that ultimately what you write, the software piece that you write, if you organize it right, if you analyze it right, if you are able to predict how well it works, and then you build this, ultimately it ends up in the hands of you and to be able to make your day-to-day life better. So here is examples of monitoring in a subway station, knowing somebody left a bag, and then crowding, getting an understanding of how much crowding there is so that you can actually open the turnstile in some cases or close the turnstile. And then this actually shows you, for instance, a system that if you are ever going to Norway, you will see, which does understand how long it takes for you to go from the check-in counter through the security into the aircraft. Okay, so in all of these techniques, all of the systems that are built here, they use machine learning, they use data analysis, computer vision, and they essentially are reasonably complex systems. Yeah. But even all of these things, if you look at it carefully, you could argue that some of these things a child can do. In other words, a child, a five-year-old child or a six-year-old child might already be able to do these tasks. To be able to make these systems work at that level of performance, like even a child, is already a challenge, was a challenge. Okay. And so therefore, there's a lot more we've learned through this process. So what is the summary of this part of the talk? The key summary essentially is you're flooded with information. We essentially have lots of data everywhere, a lot of pictures, a lot of chats, a lot of messages going floating around, lots of sensors, everything connected, and it's overbearing. You can't do anything about it. You have to deal with it. So you need actually automation systems. You need software systems that will deal with that. And the impact of this, essentially, the key challenge essentially is how do you bring the human plus the machine together in a way that you can actually leverage the best parts of the human and the best parts of the machine together. And that itself is already a research challenge that has to be solved. For example, in an autonomous car, when do you actually let the car drive and when the human takes over? Or should the human even care? And there are different opinions about that. For example, Google would say, no, leave it alone to the machine because humans make mistakes. And if you ever read the news, you would know that, for example, Google car had accidents with more of human drivers. And they said it's human driver's fault. But the point essentially is that it's not so much to talk about whose fault it is, but the point is that ultimately you have to pay attention to how the software technologies we're building and the humans are integrated in a way that we can leverage with the best of all the worlds. Yeah. And the impact of these, from a Siemens perspective, it was on healthcare, industry, energy, and so effectively you're able to, for example, use it for safety and security, you're able to improve it for diagnostics, you're able to improve, for example, for improving the power plants, efficiency, and so on. Now, already when I was in Siemens, and then it was in 2010 when I presented this, we basically realized the kinds of systems we were building, it looked like the brain. It essentially had the flavor of a brain. It had actually these two kinds of systems. One part of the system is what we call intuition, and the other one essentially is the deliberation system. If you ever read one of the latest books by a psychologist called Daniel Kahneman, who essentially wrote a book called Think Fast, Think Slow, essentially, he talks about the brain essentially as having two types of processes. One, essentially, which is the fast process, which is the intuition, which is quick, fast, it's able to come to quick decisions, but it is error-prone. It can make errors, but most of the time it's right, perhaps 80% or 90%. And then on top of it, you have the deliberative process, which recognizes that this quick process essentially may be flawed, and then makes it changes and checks facts, and then comes to a decision. So it is a mechanism in the brain to have the ability to respond in real time, in quick fashion. So you have this massively parallel process, which is the intuition process, which gets you partial answers. And then you have the next process, which is the deliberation process, which does the fact checking and so on, and basically comes to conclusions. And by the way, that's actually very similar to what we did in all our systems in Siemens. So effectively, we had a fast process and then a deliberative process. And then connecting to these things is a central memory, which is what I mentioned at the beginning of the talk, that we have a large memory, and we acquire information from experience, and we store them. And what exactly is that representation? What is that data structure itself is an open research question. There are people working on it, but there are ideas. But there is people that, you know, you can think about neural network, you can think about connected, you know, large and hierarchical neural network and so on, recurrent neural network. But the point is that these are all complex open problems, and computer science scientists have to work with biologists, neuroscientists, others to make these advances. So I gave you a perspective of what is going on in terms of what I was doing in Siemens and some of Siemens perspective, some examples. Now I'm going to go slightly into a different direction and say, okay, after I moved to Frankfurt, this was in 2011, we've been working on a platform for data analytics. In parallel, there were actually advances in Canada and other in Europe, as well as in the US, especially on big data and also in classification. So I'm going to bring that point of view across right now. And the main thrust behind that was actually inspiration from biology. So basically, the brain is composed of basic computational units, which are the neurons, which are connected together to other neurons. And you have what is called a cell body, and then you have this called a soma, a nucleus. Then you have these connections, dendritis, and then the axon, which connects to the other neurons, right? And you can mathematically think about essentially a biological neuron in a simpler way as basically just taking in inputs from multiple places, weighting them, and then applying a threshold function. So if it actually goes beyond some threshold, you just say, yes, I spike. Yeah. So in that sense, it's a classifier. And now, neural networks has been around since the 70s, 80s, even I think probably 60s, late 60s. Now, the reason why neural network of the 80s did not catch up yet was because computing power was not there, the amount of data was not there. And now we have both computing power data as well as some advances in the algorithms that allows you to now replicate some of the properties of the neural networks in the brain. It's not exactly biologically compatible exactly yet, but you could do things which are close to human performance in certain tasks. So the classic example of a neural network for a visual task essentially is what's called a Hubel and Wiesel's architecture, where you essentially the vision process is layered. You have what's called simple cells, you have complex cells, and you have hypercomplex cells. Simple cells respond to things like, you know, edges and so on. And then the complex cells look at combinations of those edges, like corners and so on. And then hypercomplex cells are more combinations of patterns, which are in the next layer. So essentially what you have is a deep network. So some simple primitives being extracted, output being forwarded to the next layer, which is aggregating those together and then looking at conjunctions of those things. And then the next level is again a conjunction. And so you get a complex pattern. And then these also arranged in a way that the receptive field or the area which you process, it goes, the scale goes down, meaning that it's coarser as you go up. Yeah? It's aggregating larger areas in the visual field. So that's what's going on. And the corresponding biological architecture is replicated in a multi-layer neural network, okay, which has an input layer, hidden layer, an output layer. So essentially, it takes in an input, a vector of values, puts out labels in the output. It says, I win. So therefore, this is a face, and this is a table, and this is a chair. Yeah? And I'm not going to go into this slide. It's a bit more complicated, but you can train such a network. So you can give it examples, and you can say, optimize yourself and figure out what your weights are. And then you give a structure of the network, but then the parameters of the network are learned. And the technique is called backpropagation. So the main difference between the past, the 90s and the early 2000s, and now is that before, it used to be that this kind of classification task was done by humans. Humans were designing them. They gave at least structure of the algorithm. They developed it, they used models, and they came up with the design of the algorithm. Now, basically what you have is this deep networks, which is bio-inspired, and then these deep networks can be learned with large number of data. We're talking about millions and millions of images labeled, annotated by some examples by crowds, saying this is a car, this is an elephant, this is different stuff. And then this large computing servers basically searching over possible parameters for this network that gives you the best result. And then you come up with the network, and suddenly you have a fancy Google search engine or a Microsoft search engine or a Baidu search engine. So the main concept here is you have an image, and you're able to recognize, for example, in this case, oh, that's that particular person. Yeah? And the actual processing is done by that deep network. So it takes the image, which is an array of numbers, and then maps it to intermediate representations, which are these big, thick intermediate output. And then they are processed layer by layer by layer, and then finally you get an answer, which is the classified result. The whole parameters of this network is learned by training for over a week or 2 weeks in one of the GPU machines. Right? So that's basically what the state of the art is. And this actually breakthrough happened, that this actually became very popular in 2012 when there was what's called an ImageNet challenge. The ImageNet challenge essentially was a challenge where you had millions of images and you wanted to classify. Okay, you give a picture, oh, that's a car. And then you also have a different type of a task. You give a picture, but you also localize where the car is. So there you say, there is a car in the picture. Here you say, the car is in this location in the picture, the second task. The third one might be, oh, this is this type of a breed of a dog. Yeah. So these are all different types of tasks that this ImageNet challenge posed. And they had millions of these samples and so on, and labeled. And then, here is an example of one category of pictures. The category here essentially is a hammer. And you see the variety of variability that you have. So, if you ask me what is a hammer, I would say, maybe this, I just have a handle, and I have something which attaches. That's a very highly abstract statement, and it's invariant to what the hammer could be made of. It could be made of wood, it could be made of plastic, it could be made of metal, whatever. And that is an abstraction that I've built through whatever means, maybe, yeah? Maybe partly also my computer vision training, okay? But for the deep network, that's not the abstraction that is used. The deep network essentially is given all these pictures, in fact, millions of pictures of everything, and then in the lower layers, in this example, in the lower layers here, what is going on is that the deep network is learning what is common between all these pictures. What are the basic constituents of different parts of things that repeat? And can I organize it in a layer by layer way? Yeah.
So does that emulate the way the human brain thinks as well? So the human brain would take a picture, narrow it down to things that are common of other objects with the same identity and just do the same, and it's just more efficient than the computer is currently?
Okay. The answer is yes and no, probably. Or maybe. The point is that the exact nature of the deep network, the hierarchy, idea of hierarchy, and the idea of actually using parts and then combining parts and then stacking essentially different representations, layers on top, This is common, whether it's a brain or whether it's this deep network. Okay? The nature of how exactly you do it, the details are different. At least the computational way people have been doing it, they draw inspiration from the brain, and then they go about doing their own rationale for why processing has to happen in a particular way. The only requirement that they put in the deep network is that the computations are homogeneous, meaning that just like the human brain has a homogeneous substrate. So basically, that's the main idea. So the homogeneity property, that means that every computational element, a neuron, is doing the more or less a similar thing. So in the deep network, what happens is that there are only what they call convolution. We'll come to that in the class later. Convolution, and then you have actually rectification. You take an absolute magnitude. And then you have pooling, which is aggregating neighboring values. And then you have normalization. Divisible normalization. That's about scaling for variation in brightness and so on. And then this is the same quantity, same computation that repeats again and again and again. They're stacked. Yeah? But this computational, the parameters of the computation are learned. They're different in different layers. Yeah? So that's why I said in the brain, the lower level, in the retina, already what you're doing is you're computing spatial derivatives and temporal derivatives. What do I mean by that? I mean you compute actually the difference between two values, neighboring pixel values, points. And if there is a big difference, that looks like, okay, as change in brightness. Yeah, that's a step. And that's a spatial derivative. And then a temporal derivative essentially is I move, and then right as I moved, I have a larger temporal derivative. And the retina is already doing that. And then it basically feeds that kind of output into the next layer. And then you have what's called Gabor filters, which actually look for particular spatial temporal patterns, frequency patterns. And then it recognizes that. And then there are groups of stuff on top. So that's what the brain is doing. Yeah. And the deep architectures that we talk about here don't exactly replicate that. So the challenge, so ultimately the question is, can you really replicate exactly what you know about the brain? My understanding after 4 years of work here in Frankfurt, being embedded with the neuroscientists and learning a bit more, is that there is still a lot of open theories about what's going on in the brain. It's not clear. On the other hand, the engineering side, the inspiration has been drawn, and that inspiration essentially has led to, along with the computing power advances and mathematical numerics advances, you are able to now solve big problems, these problems. But that doesn't mean that we've solved the building a brain problem. In other words, this is actually still a narrow problem, because you take a picture, you just want to label, is there a head or not, right? That's still a narrow definition. For me, actually, the ultimate system would be when you're able to be adaptive, you're able to change representations based on what it is, you're able to solve new problems, you're able to even formulate problems. So these are all big open questions. And it is context specific. For example, it is possible to build a very fast, low computing power algorithm to count the number of people in this room. I don't need a big deep network for that. But the reason I was able to do that is because I have a good contextual model of the situation. Yeah? So what I'm trying to say here is that in the representation that you have here, right? The representation that you have here, essentially, I was explaining that you have a handle and a mallet. That is kind of the representation a human would put out. But what is going on in the deep network is not exactly that. What is going on essentially is a rich representation of different types of local patterns and how the combinations may look like. And then in combination, okay, a part of the network fires to one of the pictures, and then it says, that looks like actually a hammer only looking in an oblique way because the head is pointing at me. But that's a very special case. But a number of other cases, I may even know that somebody's holding a hammer and then hitting, and just by knowing that there's a guy there, and I see part of the hammer, I see it. So there are many let's say, patterns you have to memorize, and coincidences or correlations that you learn. And these correlations are what help you in saying, okay, hey, this actually could be a hammer. That's what I meant by the intuition part of the brain. Yeah. So essentially, you learned actually certain pattern structures that repeat, and essentially you have a very fancy table, very fancy data structure that maps the input stream to a label. So basically what happened in 2012 was, and more recently, is that these this kind of deep networks started performing as good as the human expert. In fact, the best systems now are beating human experts at this. And that's largely, again, because of large amount of data, supervision, large computing, and some intelligent algorithms on top. Yeah. And the paper that actually started it all was actually this paper, AlexNet, that was in 2012, which showed, which actually built a network like this and showed that the performance is better than the other types of ways of doing things. And by the way, this is now used in speech recognition, it's used in language processing, it's used in the same homogeneous architecture. So that's basically one of the key advances in data analysis in the last years. And more recently, there's with Facebook, you actually have what's called DeepFace, which allows you to actually recognize a variety of faces and more faces and so on. The question that you asked, what are these networks learning, right? And if you go to search for Google Inception, and you then you will find this web page. Here's an illustration. So you take the top left, that's the image that's being presented to the network. And then if you ask the question, I'm thinking bananas, can I find bananas in that picture? Then there is a mathematical algorithm that you can formulate that tries to recover from the network properties you've learned what would be most likely the bananas in the picture. And that's what you see in the right. Okay, so that's the that is the hallucination part of the thing, right? So you really are hallucinating here, right? And actually, no, if you closely look at that picture, if you closely look at that random picture, you will see these little contours, you know, you'll see these little connections and so on. But not here, not in this, you have to look at the screen, okay? And similarly here, if you take such a picture here, one of the layers in that network is learning this type of patterns, like the facts that there are long contours, connected contours. Yeah, and that's again similar to the brain, by the way. Yeah. So, any questions so far? So that's my first part of the talk. So I think I was exactly on time. Any questions so far on you know, computer science, data analysis, and maybe there are some questions on what are the differences between traditional way of doing computer science, the normal algorithms, sorting, searching, other types of algorithms, optimization algorithms, and then this data analysis stuff, machine learning. Any questions? Okay, so I go next. So now the second part of the talk is going to be more now going back to the regular class. It's not much of fun, perhaps, but but this is the foundations now. So what I'm going to talk about now essentially is connect back to what Professor Mailer talked about in graph data structures. And I'll take actually a couple of examples on graph data structures and use of graph data structures in real applications. So this is actually a slide from his last presentation, okay, which talks about the PageRank algorithm and use of actually how Google solves the problem of actually identifying which of these pages are more relevant for a particular query. And you also learned in the, my understanding is that you've actually learned, you know enough about Python, you know enough about data structures, lists, trees, and queues, and so on, graphs. You know something about UML and how to think about representations using modeling, meta-level modeling. And you know something about object-oriented programming, object-oriented design. So that's what I understand you know. So I assume now I start from there. And now I just start to tie in with the PageRank algorithm and then do this in English. So it's also a nice transition from German to English. So the this particular part of the talk is actually coming from the book by Sedgwick, and it's describing this random surfer idea, which actually is at the heart of PageRank. So, as you know, the basically the World Wide Web, which was actually started in 1980, basically was a project for based on hypertext, essentially, you know, these pages linking to other pages and so on, and it allows you to basically connect among researchers. That was basically where it started in CERN, and Sir Tim Berners-Lee was one of the main architects. And essentially, in the 90s, there was actually the web browser, and basically a key application which involved getting at the heart of actually what the information is there, searching through the information and getting what relevant stuff is. So effectively, that was one of the killer applications of the 90s. And there's something similar, at least the idea of organized information and getting at organized information was already there in the 1940s. For example, Babel. So if you read this thing, you see, when it was proclaimed that the library contained all books, the first impression was one of extravagant happiness. There was no personal or world problem whose eloquent solution did not exist in some hexagon. So there's all this information out there. This inordinate hope was followed by an excessive depression, the certitude that some shelf in some hexagon held precious books and that these precious books were inaccessible seemed almost intolerable. So essentially, this is just explaining to you the importance of how to take the organized information and how to access that, have mechanisms to access that organized information. And in the 2000s, basically you have the killer application, and you can see this is one of the best interfaces also designed. It's very simple, just a plain text box, where you can just type in and then it comes back. Yeah? And so that's basically the Google one. So we go now to essentially web search. So the question that we ask is relevance and importance. For example, is this document similar to the query term? And is this document useful to a variety of users? And of course, there are many ways to probably do this. You can try to manually classify it. You can try to use some sort of feature-based method which classifies. Or you can just say, hey, I'm just going to look at actually how many pages are linked to what, and the popularity is actually a measure. That was essentially the main idea behind the Google PageRank. And already Professor Mailer talked about this and also gave you a Python source code. So basically, the main idea was you measure the popularity of the pages based on the hyperlink structure of the web. And essentially it allows you to access the world's information effectively. So what's the main idea? The main idea is actually a very simple model. So the model essentially is that you think about actually the way you surf. Okay? So I look at basically the set of possible pages. And let's assume that I'm going to surf the web. Now, essentially, you can start talking about a page that I'm in. It has a bunch of links. And then I can actually select one among those links with a high percentage of probability. So that's basically the 90-10 rule. So 90% of the time, I click one of the pages in this current page I'm looking at. But essentially, a hyperlink which is connected to this page. And then, by some magic, you're able to connect to any random page at 10%. This is not really realistic. but it's a crude model. It's a simplified model of how you could basically change your mind and go to something other in the page distribution. So essentially, 90% of the time, the surfer clicks a random hyperlink from the current page, or 10% of the time, the surfer types a random page. So the key point is that it's a crude model, but it's still useful as a web surfing model. Obviously, nobody chooses any link with random equal probability, and it's not possible to even surf every page in the web like that, and it's just a guess. And it doesn't take into account other modes of interaction, like pressing the back button or the forward button or so on, and bookmarks you may have had. So that's the point. And often in the question really is also, the web is so big. What about actually, how do you manage that? So the key concept is that you can think about actually the webs with a hyperlink as essentially a graph, right? So you can think about every one of these pages as labeled by actually a number between 0 and n minus 1 here. And then every hyperlink corresponds to a pair of integers, which is showing you the from to the to node. And so in this case, for example, this graph structure is you have five nodes, and you essentially have this kind of link structure, which is described here. And there is a notion of a transition probability. So when you're surfing from one page to the next, what you're doing is you're going from one node to the next. And you can define the chance that actually you go from one page to the next by a probability. And the network of all the probabilities, the pairs of all these probabilities arranged in a matrix, is what's called a transition matrix. And in statistics, this is basically what's called a Markov chain. So you have basically nodes and then states, and then from one state you can go to another state. And the state at which you are in next depends upon the previous state, for example. That's if that is the only case, that's called a first order Markov chain. So a transition matrix here essentially is basically illustrating actually the notion of jumping from one state to the other, and the notion of chance of jumping from one state to the other. And you can actually go from such a graph to essentially the network structure, and then you can define these probabilities to come up with a transition matrix. I'll go into details now. Wait a minute, what's going on here? For some reason, okay. I had actually done it in three other expanded slides. I'll have to do it with one slide. This looks like something maybe hidden. Those slides are hidden, perhaps. Okay, so so basically, let's just go through this example. So here is basically my input graph with these nodes. And that's the tiny description, the text file description of that graph. So 5 is the number of nodes, and then 0 is connected to 1, 1 is connected to 2 times through 2 hyperlinks, and then 1 is connected to 3 2 times, and 1 is connected to 4, and then 2 is connected to 3, and so on. Then if you can make up a link count matrix, which tells you for every one of those nodes how many nodes are connected and to what nodes are you connected. For example, the first row shows that 0 is connected to 1, so therefore there's an entry 1 on the second column, first row. Similarly, in the second row, you see there is 2, 2, 1. That corresponds to the idea of 1 being connected to 2 2 times, as well as 1 being connected to 3 2 times, and 1 being connected to 4 1 time. And then the right-hand side here is basically what is described as a degrees, or the number of nodes attached to each particular node. And you can actually take this link counts, which essentially is telling you something about the transition, and then you can multiply, you can actually take that one, and using the degree information, you can calculate the link probabilities. So you say, okay, I have to take this 90%, I have to spread it around these set of options that I have from a particular link, how much I'm jumping to the other links. And that is actually this chance. And this is the random chance that I jump to any of the page independently. And that's the uniform chance that it's 0.1 divided by 5. That's 0.02. You sum these two together, you get back a transition matrix. And this transition matrix, for example, says Okay, from going from node 1 to node 2 essentially is, for example, 0.38. So that's an illustration of a transition matrix. And you can actually construct this matrix using your Python code. So this is just showing you the implementation of the same thing in Python. So the standard stuff, you import the standard libraries, like the IO library and the array library, or modules. And then you have essentially the reading of the first number in the top, which is the number of nodes in the graph. And then you start reading the initiating the array for link counts, the out degrees, and then you read up the entire file. You make up actually the data structure for the link counts and the out degrees. And then you essentially can compute these probabilities effectively. That's what's going on here. This is that summation that you talked about. And then you write the output. So if you take this set kind of an input and then you run it through this transition.py, this is what you get, which is exactly the matrix that I showed you. Yeah. So it's a very simple Python code for that. Now, how do you then decide, once you have the transition matrix, which of these pages actually are important, or what's the rank? You can do this by what's called Monte Carlo simulation. And the name Monte Carlo simulation comes because of the association with gambling and, you know, casinos and so on, probabilities. Okay. But nevertheless, the main idea is that you're tossing a coin and then you make a decision based on the outcome of the coin. So Monte Carlo simulation. So how do you think about computing page ranks? So the way you think about it essentially is that the surfer starts at page 0, let's say. Then you repeatedly choose the next page according to this transition matrix. So you have this probability of jumping to one of the other nodes. And then you keep on doing that, and then over time, you accumulate the number of times you visit these nodes, and then divide it by the total number of times you have trials. And then that gives you already the number of times you come to one particular node. That's really the calculation of how often a surfer visits a particular page. That's exactly what you do, and this can be simulated effectively. And that's basically what it is. So here is an illustration of how that simulation goes. So here is basically my transition matrix. And given that I'm in a particular node, if I want to figure out the next place I jump, what I do is I actually select a number between 0 and 1. That's a uniform random number. And I take the probabilities in that row. I sum it together. This is a cumulative sum. And then I find out what I generated, in this case, 0.971. And it happens to be in between these two, therefore I return 2. So in a sense, you're basically what you're saying is that here is my set of options for jumping into, and here is how I think about the cumulative probability, essentially, the, for example, this row. So the node 4 transitioning to 1 is 0.47, to 0 is 0.47, 1 is 0.02, 2 is 0.47, and so on. You can actually sum these so that you can get total 1. That's the interval, 0 to 1. Then you basically choose a number between 0 and 1 randomly using a uniform random number generator. It's called a pseudo random number generator. And then whatever the number is, sometimes it may be 0.1, in which case you should return 0. Sometimes it may be 0.9, in which case you would return, in this case, 2 still. If it's 0.99 sometimes, it's basically returning, for instance, 4, likelihood of jumping to this stuff is 4, right? And so that's basically what you're doing in this. So effectively, what you're able to do is you're able to simulate that process according to the probability law. And there's a Python example which illustrates this whole stuff. I'm not going to go into a lot of detail on that, but just basically very simple use of arrays and just multiplications and random number generators. Yeah. So here you see it's reading up all the transition matrix stuff into the file, from the file. It's using a 2D array as the data structure for the transition probability matrix. And then it's using this random package, and then it's basically making up a random number using random, the call random.random. And then you basically figure out which interval it falls, and then based on that, you decide, okay, which page to go to. And then you increment the page count, essentially. And then in the end, you return, and you say, okay, this is the number of times I visited particular moves. Now, the question that you have to ask is, how long do I need to run this? So in probability, if you remember, let's say you want to check whether a coin is unbiased. So it's either heads or tails, and you want to know whether it's unbiased. How many times do you have to throw the coin up and down, and toss it before you can say it's unbiased? Anybody? So I want to know if the coin is fair. 50% chance of head, 50% chance of tail. So I toss once, I get a head. Toss once, second time, I get a head. Should I stop and say it's unbiased? Four times the? Two tails, yeah.
So until you have the amount of tries that sustains the fair result.
That's an interesting point. Yeah, I mean, let's say you do two times, you get a head, you get a tail, you get a head and a tail, and then you get now suddenly head. Okay, so the answer is that basically it can be explained. There is a formal way you can analyze, essentially, how many number of samples do you need to essentially do in order to be absolutely sure that the statistical conclusion, the conclusion about the statistics that you're drawing, is actually accurate. And basically, this is basically, so in other words, the number, ideally, if the number of samples essentially is 1,000 and million, right? And you can basically do these, just count the number of heads divided by the total number of trials. You could, if it comes to 0.949999, I'd say, okay, that looks like a fair coin. Yeah. But if it's, let's say, only 100 trials, maybe I get 0.498. Maybe if I 10, maybe I get 0.45. Yeah. So essentially, this is what's called sampling variance. So the number of samples that you use essentially will, as long as if the samples go to infinity, and if each of the tosses are independent trials, it's a very important point. They are independent trials, and they are what's called identical independently distributed measurements, random variables. So in that case, then you can actually make some conclusions about how many samples do you need before you can say with probability 99%, yes, I'm coming to the conclusion right. Any other question? Okay. So, but it's the same thing here. So the same thing here, that if you run this through for a particular number of times, maybe 100 trials, depending on the size of the graph, then you can actually say, oh, okay, it is converged to some number. And you can check for the convergence. Yeah. And by the way, there are certain properties that these Markov chains have to have in order for you to even have convergence. And I'm not going to go into that in this class. So the point is that the main idea that's used here is that if you start with a random surface model, the fraction of the time that the surfer spends is actually on each page converges to a unique distribution, independent of the starting page. And so here is basically an illustration of this, and then that's kind of the converged numbers. And you can see here, for example, label page 0 and page 1 seem to be dominant. And the idea of actually what's called mixing is actually you can also do the same thing by using the probability instead of doing the simulation. You can also do this by calculation. So you can take actually the transition matrix you have, start with a particular move, and then you can actually multiply a vector with a matrix to get back again the probability of being in other states, starting from the first state. And then by the property of Markov chain, which says that if I'm actually starting from any random place and then I keep going for a long time, then basically the property of mixing says that ultimately I would have converged to a stationary distribution of the Markov chain. That actually gives you, and the eigen, the first eigenvalue, eigenvector of this transition matrix corresponds to this the solution that you had before. So this is actually, so you can actually do the same computation by just using vector and matrix products and then running it through many times and then finding out what the numbers are. So for example, here you start with zero, you, after one step you get this kind of a probability, and then after that if you do the second time you get, you go from there to here, and then you go again more times, and you keep moving, and over time it converges to an, the same number that you had before with from the simulation. Yeah? So this is what's called the power method. Yeah? And in a sense, basically what you get is the same answers that you saw before. Yeah? Now let me ask you a question. When do you normally stop? Do you stop at actually exactly at 10, or do you stop at earlier? Right now, oh yeah, sorry, 11. Exactly 11, you stop, okay. Just want to make sure. So because there's some people who left, I thought maybe, yeah. Okay. So the, so what I showed you here essentially is a very simple toy example. The idea of actually the random surfer model, the idea of using transition matrices, and the idea of Markov chains, and how you can compute actually the relevance of a particular page, or the importance of a particular page through this method. And actually doing this for a large matrix, because you know, if you talk about a large web network with tons of pages, billions and billions of pages, you have these big matrices. How to actually make it practical and how to make it run, that's also requires linear algebra and other tools to make this work. Yeah. So that's actually interesting, has some interesting articles on that. It's also referred in the book. So essentially, the as you say, if you talk about 4 billion by 4 billion matrix, you need appropriate data structures, and you need good linear algebra to essentially make this possible. Any questions on this section? Okay, now we go to one more example and we wrap up. So the page rank was one example. Now, I'm just again going to highlight something about graph data structures and the idea of actually particular types of graphs, essentially which are pervasive and what's called small world networks. And then this particular book only also gives you code for doing computations on the small world networks and gives you a graph data structure, so I urge you to read the chapter. So what is the small world phenomenon? Yeah. The small world phenomenon essentially is that you actually, there was an experiment that was conducted in the 1960s. So what you have to do is you give actually a personal information, you're given a personal information of another person, and your goal is to deliver a message. So the restriction is that you can only forward to someone you know by first name. Okay. And then if you do this, it turned out that when you do this multiple times, actually, and just doing a chain, it turned out almost that with mean value of 5 trials, 5 steps, you always reach the final goal. So in that sense, what you're saying is that the world is composed of many people, and then I know you, he knows somebody else, and she knows somebody else, and so on and so on. And if I'm just handing off people based on my friends, yeah, it turns out that after 5 hops, it's in your hand, okay? Even if I didn't know you. Okay? And that's basically a characteristic of this network. It's called a small world network. Yeah? And this essentially is, for example, there is an exam, there's a movie example with Kevin Bacon. Okay, if you start with Kevin Bacon movie Can you, and then see which actors you worked with, can you go back and then loop around and find out again when you reach back again to Kevin Bacon? In other words, you send a message out through the network, which is basically defined according to the roles they played, or let's say the movies they played, and then you just basically want to ask, if I send a message, can I get the message back in how many hops? That's again a small world type network problem. So what are the kinds of applications of this stuff? For example, in sociology, looking for a job, marketing products or ideas, formation and spread of fames and fads, a train of thought followed in a conversation. So these are all sort of messages that are passing around in a network. And for example, this Kevin Bacon game, which is actually explained in the book. There are other applications of this stuff. For example, synchronization of neurons. We talked about the brain, right? Analysis of the World Wide Web, and then electrical power grids, and so on. So a whole range of basically application areas. And the core, of course, is the graph data structure. You know the graph data structure, where here you're talking about the vertex, which are the nodes, and the edges, which are connections. And the kinds of graphs that you have in a variety of these applications involve, for example, in the communication network, you're talking about telephones and computers. Or in a circuit, you're talking about gates and registers and processes. And the edges are basically wires, for example. So connections between gates, basically, and then you have a circuit. Mechanical devices, for example, where you have joints and beams and so on. Or financial, where you have stocks and currency and then transactions, which are links. And so on. So you see, you can think about actually almost all of the scenarios in the real world in terms of graphs, structures involving vertices and edges. Even actually, if you take the this is again from the book. So what's called a kissing network is a small world network, by the way. And if you take high school dating, it's a small world network. And if you take corporate email communications, it's a small world network. And you take power grid, very similar. Yeah. And protein modeling, protein interactions, that's again, you can think of it as a small world network. And the internet, the ARPANET, which was actually founded in the 70s, essentially, small world network. And now the current internet, which is essentially, again, can be thought of this way. And you can think about, for example, in a movie domain, you can think about a network where you have a movie, which is actually, and then list of performers, which are all separated by slashes. And that could be actually a database. And then you can represent that by a graph. And the graph representation that you're talking about uses the vertex, which is actually the performer. And then a link basically means that, OK, the performer performs to a, basically, a performer on a movie is a vertex. And the link essentially is connecting the performer and the movie. Yeah. So this is actually the network that you can form with a movie database. Yeah. And the question that you can ask is, OK, here is Kevin Bacon. Can you tell me, OK, how many hops do you need before the message that he passes comes back to you? In a shortest distance sense. So when you do that, now you can, of course, you've seen that already in Professor Mailer's presentation, graphs, how you think about graph data structures, what kind of object-oriented design you can have for graphs. This book essentially gives you another implementation of graphs structures. So I'm not going to go into detail of exactly the structure here. And I'm just going to focus on this main problem of the point that, okay, what you're talking about is finding a small, shortest path in this network, which is basically starting from here, going, and then coming back. And that shortest path algorithm essentially can be solved by different methods. And one of the methods that I'm going to talk about essentially is a breadth first search. And this book gives you actually a algorithm for that, and you can take a look. So how do you actually do shortest path So for example, you can say, start with the source vertex, which is distance 0, that's A in this case. And then I can look at its neighbors and say, OK, all of my neighbors, I write one, basically write a number which is actually corresponds to distance 1 above my current distance. So in this case, B and I are both distance 1. Then I can look at the neighbors of B and neighbors of I. And now again, those numbers I can actually increment by 1, saying, OK, I've visited now E and F. And E and F essentially now have two distance 2 from 0. Then I take these guys, and again, I can ask, what are its neighbors? And then I can then increment 1 again to the new neighbor. In this case, for example, G is incrementing, is labeled 3, because 3 essentially corresponds to a distance of 2 plus 1 from the F. And then similarly, G, for further again, you can look at its neighbors. And then now those neighbors are 4 from 0. And then the last one, D, is at a distance of 5 from 0. So the question for you essentially is to, so this is sort of the notion of the distance between two nodes and how we can compute the distances. And what you want essentially is the shortest path between two nodes, or shortest paths. The way you solve that problem essentially is by using a breadth first search. So I think you've already been seeing queues, or queue data structures. We're talking about now using a first-in, first-out queue data structure. So you take actually the source vertex, put it into the first-in, first-out queue. And then you basically keep on looping until the queue is empty. That's the algorithm. And you look at the least recently added vertex V and take it out. And then what you do is you look at its unvisited neighbors, and then you add it into the queue. Okay, that's essentially saying, okay, here are my neighbors, I'm not visited, put them into the queue. And then I again go back to the first item in the queue, take it out, look at its neighbors, and then put it back in. So in that sense, I'm going breadth first. Okay, and then I basically mark all the things that I've put in as visited, so that I don't revisit things that I've already put in, right? And so effectively what you're doing is your vertex are essentially are visited in increasing order of distance because you're using this first-in, first-out queue. Yeah, that's the main point. And effectively this is the illustration of, for instance, what would be the shortest paths. For example, in this, this is actually a graph involving airports and the connections. And for example, between JFK and LA, New York and LA, basically there's a distance 3 link, shortest path, that goes through, for example, Chicago, JFK to Chicago, ORD, to Phoenix, to LA. So that's basically the link, that link that is there. And similarly, Las Vegas and so on. The book actually presents the code and the examples. I urge you to read it. It's not that complicated. I just wanted to use this example as a complimentary example to the PageRank to give you an idea of graphs and the use of graphs, shortest path problems, and other problems that arise which are useful for particular applications. And the book also describes how you can construct shortest path 3, which essentially is a data structure that allows you to know which are the shortest paths. Yeah. And the breadth first search actually can be used for many other applications involving particle tracking, image processing, crawling the web, and so on. And also it's used in Google Maps. So I'm just concluding. So in conclusion, what essentially I have said today is two parts. One is, of course, a bit more longer term, systems-oriented view of where computer science is going and what essentially data analysis is, and some of the examples to give you a flavor of real-world problems. The second part of it was really a continuation of the data structures knowledge that you had and builds upon that. The next class would be more on data analysis and how we can use some examples of data analysis and how we can program in Python using for big data. Okay, questions? Yeah, go ahead. Pardon? Yes, 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 sorry. This is, you know, I was trying to still, I tried to synchronize with the others and then try to find the best way to present and organize this. So that's why this one was not put in yet. So I'll do that by, most likely by Sunday. Okay. Thank you.